Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's world service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Maradona turns like a little eel and comes away from trouble. Little squat man leaves it for dead.
There's Beckham, there's the ball on. There's Beckham!
England are scoring a lot of goals at this tournament. My, oh my, that'll be an average of 3 per game. They haven't conceded one in the last 3 matches either, but they haven't faced Kylian Mbappe yet, or new record French goal scorer Olivier Giroud for that matter. You're welcome to your Sunday night World Cup podcast. Hi, Kieran.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
It's going okay. It might be time to start reckoning with England going on a run in a major tournament. Just, you know, there is that slight fly in the ointment that they're playing an amazing team
in the
quarterfinals.
I mean, if you were of a mind to get worried about such things, I wouldn't be that worried about such things, quite frankly, because Kylian Mbappe looks like he's in the mood to do something kind of unprecedented. Well, I say unprecedented. It is precedented in that Maradona won a World Cup by himself in 1986. Mm-hmm. And Mbappe is doing things at the moment that are pretty unbelievable. And if he puts 3 more performances like the last 3 he's put in, then that's the sort of territory we're in.
He could end up being as good as Maradona, winning the tournament on his own. Have you forgotten the record, man? The player who did do something unprecedented, at least for the French men's senior football team tonight.
Mbappé qui peut donner à Olivier Giroud. Bien sûr. Olivier Giroud toujours. Olivier Giroud pour l'éternité. Olivier Giroud dans la légende.
Giroud pour l'éternité, Murph. Pour l'éternité. And you're saying you forgot him 20 minutes later when your boy Mbappe started hogging the line lights half an hour later.
Quite frankly, only yes. Giroud pour l'éternité.
Pretty good. That's a good one. We're going to chat to Philippe Auclair about all that and about Arsene Wenger's claim that the performance of teams at this tournament benefited from focusing on performance rather than political demonstration, as in the ones that didn't focus on political demonstration with the ones performing well in the early stages. He made those comments in his guise as chief of global football development at FIFA, so I'm sure Philippe Auclair will be interested in that. That is 5 goals in this tournament for Mbappe, 2 clear in the Golden Boot stakes. Also 5 goals in World Cup knockout games, which compares quite favourably with some greats of the gamer.
Yeah, quite favourably indeed. Lionel Messi 1, Cristiano Ronaldo 0, Kylian Mbappe 5. And that's in five knockout games. Yeah. So he's averaging a goal a game in World Cup knockout games. I mean, Gary Lineker was tweeting about it. Gary Lineker actually still has more goals in knockout games than Messi, Ronaldo and Kylian Mbappe combined. So I mean, I'm not saying that these stats are gold plated, but at the same time, they are indicative of a player who enjoys this level of competition.
Well, you mentioned Messi's one, which he finally got on the board on Saturday night against Australia in his 1,000th professional football match. They do know how to roll their oars on DirecTV Sports Argentina. That's for certain. Ken was there to see Messi's sumptuous performance. We'll play that chat later in today's pod. Ken was there for his first look at England in the flesh in the tournament just this evening. So that'll be our first chat. There is another episode out for you, by the way, over the weekend with Murph and Ken reflecting on the end of the group stages, the turmoil of Luis Suarez in particular. That one is available for everybody, but only our World Service members will be in position to hear all our coverage of the last 16 during the week and bleeding into the quarterfinals, which begin on Friday, don't they? Yes, they do.
Friday.
SecondCaptains.com. Yep. €5 a month plus VAT if you want to sign up. We also can't wait to see many of our members in the Liberty Hall. What a week it's going to be for the gangs on here. And suitably deranged noises you're making there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it though. I mean, it's going to be fun.
It's going to be good. That's the gangs on here. End of year shows back in their rightful December slot, it should be said,
yes,
as well. So
yes,
double the fun.
It didn't feel right, did it, in March? You know, it was good. We enjoyed it. It was good. But there's something about Christmas. Christmas hasn't begun until we've hit Liberty Hall.
Here's Ken post England.
There's a voice.
Oh my God. Sorry, mate. That's actually my seat.
What you think doesn't really matter.
He's an annoying twat.
Walk away saying the word tosser. I had a number of Budweiser.
I've got friends in low places. I'm going to have to re-register myself as Aaron Aardvark.
In the hotel staff are like, oh, you need to go to the hospital, sir.
Well, what's next for you? What's next for Hathaway?
FIFA.
Didn't let me in.
What a boy you are.
Ken, England 3, Senegal 0. Impressed?
Yeah, pretty impressed in some ways, Owen. What impresses me about England is how clinical they are when they, you know, in terms of scoring their chances. And Senegal, I think, could learn a lot from that, you know, because that was, I think, the biggest difference. Senegal had a couple of early chances, didn't make them count. England had a couple of chances and buried theirs. You know, and Bellingham is extremely good.
Yeah, exactly.
Jude Bellingham is an extremely good player. And I do think, you know, there have been sort of rumors flying around here before that Bellingham wasn't going to be in the team. Mm-hmm. It seemed like insane. Obviously, those rumors proved to be incorrect. Because, you know, you see people picking their England teams, you know, my England 11, and, you know, some people are like, Sterling has to play, he's experienced, he delivers a big time. Some people are like, Foden is obviously the best English player, obviously he has to play. Other people are like, Rashford is in form, Rashford, he should be playing. Others are like, man, Mount gives balance, you know, he gives a good balance in the field. Others are like, Henderson, you know, Henderson should come in there. Absolutely everybody has got Jude Bellingham in their team.
Oh, yeah.
Luckily, so did Gareth Southgate tonight, luckily for England anyway, and I thought he was probably the outstanding England player. Thought they had good performances from a few players. Obviously, Kane managed to score his first goal. Saka got his third of the World Cup, which is a fantastic performance from him. Sterling was actually the absentee, but not because he'd been dropped. England had released news just before the game that he was going to miss this game. He wasn't available because he was dealing with an as yet unspecified family issue. So he went with Foden. Foden basically on the left, Saka on the right, Kane in the middle, Bellingham in the kind of number 10 role. And I thought that was probably the right choice. And a back four, obviously, with Kyle Walker at right back, meaning Kieran Trippier wasn't in the team. If I was to be critical of England, I'd say that their first half performance actually wasn't very good. I mean, they started off You know, I think there were some very good things about them in terms of their clinical finishing, the kind of speed, their kind of expert counterattacking. Like, they ripped Senegal to shreds on counters. The problem that they had was making things happen themselves from possession. And that was, they sort of lost their way, you know, in the first half. I mean, there was a chance early on for Boulaye Dia who kind of ran through. And all I could think looking at it was, if this is Sadio Mane running through, this is a different situation. As it was, Stones and Maguire managed to kind of snuff this one out between them. He sort of managed to get past Stones, but Maguire was there to sort of cover. You know, and then England kind of got into the game, and there was a couple of hard crosses sort of whacked across goal, always with Saka in the middle. It was Bellingham, I think, and Kane hitting these hard crosses. And you're thinking, well, you know, maybe this should be the other way around or whatever. Little Saka can't get these. Neither could Mendy, who kept coming for them and missing them. I was wondering if this was like a ploy by, have they noticed Mendy sort of being a bit indecisive or coming for things he can't get? And it sort of felt for those first 15 minutes like this is really only a matter of time before England break them down. And then weirdly, they just sort of lost control. You know, there was just a lot of sort of passing around at the back, lack of imagination. Rice and Henderson in midfield with Bellingham not really able to make anything happen. You know, it was just Maguire to Stones to Maguire to Stones. You know, just sort of like, what are we supposed to do with it? And actually, Senegal then started to come into the game and did have a couple of chances. There was one penalty shout where the ball, I think Maguire gave it away. The ball came back down the right, crossed into the box. Dia had a shot, hits John Stones on the leg, then the arm, and then Ismaïla Sarr coming in behind him, blasts the ball over the bar. I think Pickford was very close to him, so maybe it was a slightly difficult chance, but again, it looked scorable. The VAR decided it's not a penalty because of the ball, even though it clearly hit Stones' arm, has hit his leg first. And then Ismaïla Sarr started getting a bit of, the left winger for Senegal started getting some real joy attacking Kyle Walker. And this, I think, is the big thing that Gareth Southgate's going to be thinking about tonight and before the France game. Because Kyle Walker is supposed to be England's best one-on-one defender. You know, he's the guy who's quickest, strongest, hardest to beat. You know what I mean? You can see how players can walk past Maguire, you know, Stones' strength is not really defending. But Walker is supposed to be, you know, Walker reputedly, I think it was Jacob Steinberg said to me earlier, considers that there's nobody faster than him in the game. Now, it's not just a question of speed, what Sarr was doing to him, but Walker obviously has had injuries, or he had an injury for City, didn't play the last few games, I think, leading up to the World Cup. And I thought he looked well short of his best. You know, Sarr beat him, and then a couple of minutes later did him again, and he should have been booked for grabbing Sarr. It was an obvious booking. And incredibly, the referee let him away with that, gave a free kick, didn't book him, which was a terrible decision, I thought, because, I mean, what is the yellow card for? You know, a guy's been beaten, it's a dangerous attack, and he just grabs the guy. That's like, how can that not be a yellow card? I really do not understand some of the refereeing I've seen. And, you know, it was a decision as ridiculous, although not as consequential, as the one with the Arrascaeta, the Uruguay stamp, which was just ignored. You know, it's like, how can you ignore that? Anyway, they took the free kick, think about it, for a goal kick, and then England scored immediately from that. And it was as though Senegal were kind of asleep at the wheel a little bit with this goal kick, and just kind of came down the left, Kane dropping very deep. Because I had been looking at Kane thinking, why are you playing in midfield so much? They've got three midfielders. You know, like, what is your obsession with this? But, you know, he actually gets on the ball in midfield, turns, plays it through. Bellingham has run past him. Bellingham down the left, rolls a ball across into part of Henderson, who's arriving from midfield. And Henderson, great left-footed, first-time finish, sweeps it into the net. A lovely goal, 1-0. And, you know, all of Senegal's sort of pressure or possession that they built up over the last 15 minutes now just feels almost demoralizing. It's like, oh, you know, we thought we were getting on top here, and now we're behind. And so Senegal then tried to take it back to England again as the same sort of pattern. And England are more dangerous when the other team is having the ball, you know, compared to when they're trying to think of something. You know, when it's Maguire and whatever, you know, what will we do? It's better when the other team pushes up and then does something stupid like losing the ball to Bellingham. This was the probably Bellingham's best individual piece of play. I mean, he did lots of great things, but, you know, gets the ball, kind of shrugs off a challenge, sees a guy in front of him, just effortlessly goes past that guy, you know, from a standing start.
Glides past, man, is what I have on my notes here, Ken.
It's great because Bellingham's a big guy. And to be able to do that, and he had no pace to begin with. It wasn't like he was coming onto a ball, was able to sort of use his speed to, you know, to beat the man. He developed the speed, easily went around this guy, seemed to know exactly what was happening around him. As Foden broke on the left, Kane on the right, picks out Foden. Foden's ball across to Kane. I think it hit the defender and actually made it even a slightly better pass for Kane. Just came into his path, takes a touch, and then just whacks the pass to keeper. So at that point, you're like, well, this is a game over. Because Senegal are not a free-scoring team. They've already missed chances. England are 2-0 up. Very, very lethal on the counter-attack, as we've seen. Senegal are going to have to come after them if they want to score, and England are going to score again. And in fact, that is what happened. Again, it was Senegal around halfway, kind of a silly pass. Shaw steps in, intercepts. Shaw, Foden, Shaw, Kane. Foden is now running away down the left. Kane into Foden. And Foden, with that funny style he has, like he's kind of, his like arms seem to be sort of out. He's like, he's a funny little creature. Is that a patronizing way to describe Phil Foden?
Yeah, reasonably patronizing, but I will allow it.
He's kind of on his toes and his arms are kind of out wide and he's just sort of almost dancing along. And Koulibaly comes over and he kind of, puts a pass through Koulibaly's legs and Saka's there. It's just such an easy, makes it look so easy, I should say. The ball's coming across and just dinks it over. Mendy 3-0.
He's doing a lot of damage from the left, Phil Foden, for a player who, you know, we know that Southgate prefers the idea, as most managers do these days, of the opposite footed player playing on each wing. But he's doing a lot of this traditional, it was as traditional wing play as it gets. His setup of that goal. I don't want to just gloss over Bellingham though, because I think he's probably the biggest story of the day. The timing of his passes, that first goal, I saw whatever commentator
delays the pass.
Yes, whatever commentator I was saying said, oh, he didn't really, he just had to put it in an area there and hope somebody was there. I didn't think so. I thought he delayed it just enough to give himself the angle and give Henderson a chance to get to the area he needed to be in. Then he released it, which is perfect. And as you described there, there was nothing fancy about his pass to Foden for the Kane goal, but having already, you often see players tear past one or two and then not really sure what to do, or they try to beat another one, but he just made the right angle for himself and again just played the perfectly way to pass at the right time. Again, this is the kind of stuff that most 18-year-old players you wouldn't expect to have in their locker. Not 19.
Yeah, I would also say though that counterattack goals are supposed to look easy. You know, like really brilliant counterattack teams make it look easy. It's just the right pass hit at the right time to the right person, and then a second pass hit at the right time to the right person. And that's usually enough to get you 70 yards up the pitch. So, I mean, forget about 19-year-olds. It's actually not that common for midfielders to do it as perfectly as Bellingham
and
did.
And he's physically imposing, and he can beat players, and he knows when to release. He's like a rich man's Declan Rice.
Here, listen, is there any chance of us getting middle-aisle Jude Bellingham to declare back for us? Because, like, what is even the point of Declan Rice anymore?
Well, someone has to mind the house while Jude Bellingham's out there winning the game, you know? someone's got to mind the garden.
Someone's
going
to
be Jordan Henderson's deputy minder of the house while Jude Bellingham goes
assisted
and wins the World
to
Cup.
It wasn't really a game in which Declan Rice was much in evidence, I suppose. It was an easy game. I mean, from that point on, the game was just about England trying to avoid injuries, conserving energy, giving lads a run out, you know, Rashford, Grealish. Kane didn't come off, did he?
No, he didn't. No.
Nah, he won't really.
Harry Kane's the same as Messi. I mean, if Southgate was honest about it, and he'd say, well, if he tells me to take him off, I'll take him off.
Yeah. So that was, you know, and it was easy. And Senegal, there wasn't much they can do. They didn't have the quality to do it. They were missing big players, obviously. We knew that they've done reasonably well, I think, to almost overcome that loss to get to this point, although they were in one of the easier groups. And once they had sort of missed those chances and England scored theirs, then they were never coming back here. So really all England were already thinking about France, I think, from halftime in this game. And I think there's a few things to think about. You know, France, I think, are the best team England will have played in a tournament since Southgate has been the manager. You know, if you look back...
Yes. Yeah.
They played Belgium, sure, in 2018 when Belgium finished third, lost to France in the semifinals. And Belgium actually beat England in both the games, but neither game was really a proper game because one of them was the third group game when both sides had already qualified. And one of them was a third place game that neither side really cared about. So, you know, then they played Germany and they played Italy in the Euro 2020 campaign and also beat Denmark in the semi. I think that this French team is clearly a level above either of those sides. And when you see what Mbappe did earlier on today, two goals and an assist and just absolutely destroyed Poland. I won't say single-handed because there was other French players who were, you know, Olivier Giroud broke the French scoring record, obviously. That, you know, they looked really in control of the game. One player can't control a game of his own, but the two goals were just absolutely sensational. It was like, here I am, you know, I'm the best. I heard a lot about Lionel Messi last night, my club mate. Messi's a good player, but I'm going to let you finish, but I am the best player in the world right now. You know, the combination of power and speed and skill and insight is, you know, he is the best player in the world. I mean, the pass, I know the two goals are both incredible. You know, the first goal that he scores, the way that he just takes his time before lashing it into the top corner, you're kind of like, what's taking you so long to get this shot off? But he's just like, yeah, you know, I've got plenty of time. And then the other one showing that he can go the other side as well. But the pass to Giroud to create the first goal was honestly nearly as good. You know, so quickly, the ball came into him and just he's already turning and playing the ball through Giroud with a nice finish. So France, who I saw play against Denmark and beat Denmark without really playing very well, do look a stronger team than England. And the big concern for England has got to be, if Ismaïla Sarr can do this to Kyle Walker, then what's Kylian Mbappe going to do? So if I'm Gareth Southgate, if I'm going to try and imagine myself into Gareth Southgate's mentality, right? What is his distinguishing mark, sort of as England coach, has been, you know, let's not lose the heads here, lads. Settle down, take it easy, or take it handy. Let's not go. What was the phrase Steve Staunton used in his famous first press conference for Bobby Robson? I might go in there like a raging bull.
Mm.
That's the opposite of that. That's what the Southgate is like, the opposite of that, which is obviously the thing that he gets criticized for a lot by people say, you know, a lot of the sort of media criticism will talk about leashes and shackles.
I wouldn't want to see these lads with the shackles off. They've scored 12 goals so far in four games.
Yeah, I know. It's true, Owen. Exactly. This is why I'm saying Southgate has done, things couldn't have really gone better for Southgate to get to this point. They're the joint top scorers in the tournament along with France. So what if some of those goals are on the counter-attack? I mean, there's nothing wrong with counter-attacks, and they're brilliant. They're a brilliant counter-attacking team. But Southgate, I think, will not want to take the risk of playing a back four with Kyle Walker at right back against Kylian Mbappe. I think that he will change the team to...
Three. Yeah.
I don't think he's going to.
That's been kind of marked all the way along, hasn't it? But I kind of find it strange that they haven't, that they're just going to revert to that now. Have they played that in the tournament yet? I mean, maybe these players are well adapted enough to changing systems that it won't be any problem. But
Dyer came on for Stones tonight. I mean, you know, there was an argument to be made to try it now, but at the same time, what's really the point? I mean, what do you actually learn from doing it for 15 minutes or 20 minutes against Senegal in a round of 16 game?
In answer to your question, Owen, they have not played with a back five yet, whatever you want to call it, in the tournament. Against Iran, it was 4-2-3-1. Against the US again, 4-2-3-1. But that was a game in which the Americans had a disturbingly large percentage of action in midfield and also chances, and where England themselves couldn't really get a grip of things. So he brought Jordan Henderson in for the next game, which was a more convincing victory against Wales, who I don't think are anywhere near as good as the United States, and moved Bellingham forward, which is what obviously he did again tonight against Senegal. But none of those teams are like France. Like, England are far stronger, really, than those four sides.
Yeah.
I know the Americans obviously got the nil-nil and played well against them, but really England are looking at those teams going, yeah, this, you know, these are all winnable games. Against France, England will feel themselves to be, I mean, they are the underdogs. You know, France are the world champions. They've got the world's best player. They've got really strong players throughout their, you know, stronger than England's players, more experienced players. When I say strong, I mean physically strong. I don't necessarily mean strong to mean better. England have got some really good players. But I think if you're Gareth Southgate, are you going to think, well, I'm going to go out there toe-to-toe with France, even though Kyle Walker, you know, got diddled by Ismail Assar and sent him out against Mbappe? I think you might think, no, I have to do something about that. I have to react to that. Now, again, maybe Southgate's just going to close his eyes and say, look, it's the same team. Just go out there and express yourselves, lads. Maybe he will do that. Maybe that's what's going to happen. I feel as though he's going to bring in Trippier, move Walker to the right of a back three. And yeah. Then the question becomes, who comes out of the team?
The answer being?
Hey, you're asking me for a lot here.
The answer will end up being Jordan Henderson.
No, he's not going to take Jordan Henderson out at this point. Declan Rice is hardly coming out, is he?
No, I mean, Rice isn't coming out. Obviously, Bellingham can't come out. Can he? No. Surely not.
No.
Surely not. Hendo, does Hendo come out? I mean, he played quite well today, scored a goal. Himself and Bellingham seem to have a real... close relationship.
Yeah, they're a nice nose-to-nose kind of intimate celebration between the two of them.
I couldn't remember seeing a celebration quite as fond as that between these two foreign friends. But look, do you take him out? You probably do, right? Because, I mean, if the formation is going to be 3-4-3, then really that means two central midfielders. It's not going to be Bellingham who comes out. It's not going to be Rice who comes out, surely. Probably is going to be Henderson. You need your three forwards. Is Sterling going to be back? Well, we'll know more about that, I'm sure, over the coming days. I don't know exactly what the situation is, whether they've been able to resolve this problem that kept them out of the game tonight. Obviously, Foden has been very good. Rashford has been good, but maybe Rashford's been too good off the bench. You know what I mean? Maybe he's an easier player to leave out for that reason, because then you have someone on the bench.
Yeah.
And Saka, I mean, Saka scored three goals and just looked fantastic. So, okay, they've got good options, but having to change the formation does mean... Maybe Henderson is the obvious choice in that situation, but I don't think it's an easy one.
If England pull this one off against France, Ken, I'll have no more of your Southgate bashing on this podcast, because he'll have pulled one out of the hat if he can finish France with an absolutely prime Kylian Mbappe, who we're about to hear about. Now, you were also at the Argentina-Australia match over the weekend, so we'll hear about that one after our chat with Philippe.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Timbuktu.
Yo, listen up, here's the story.
An old pumpet.
A little guy that lives in a blue world.
We haven't got leaders. They're all just headphones. Inside and outside, blue. They don't communicate.
You can't get anything out of them.
That's why we're no good.
Timbuktu.
They're all just headphones.
They don't communicate on the pitch. They don't communicate off the pitch.
They're all pampered.
Oh, we're getting ready for Russia. Good luck.
And then after that, we'll be building a team for Timbuktu.
Timbuktu.
How have England reacted to that equaliser?
Perfectly. No panic. Calm straight down. Continue dominating the game, playing and staying in Iceland's heart. It's been a perfect response. You'd think that no problem.
England were up after 4 minutes. And they still lost.
Maggie Thatcher, your guys took a hell of a beating.
Maggie Thatcher, you boys took a hell of a beating.
The only thing that they have got is the big boy up front, Sigurdsson, who really, Sigurdsson.
Oh, my word. Tell us, talk us through that, Steve. I think we know what's happened.
Oh, just say, Sigurdsson.
He just cannot.
Philippe Auclair, great to chat to you. How are you?
I'm better than I was 2 hours ago, and probably not as well as I will be. When is it? Wednesday? Thursday?
Friday.
I think Friday. It's Friday. Friday night. Whatever. No, I'm okay actually.
Yeah, relieved. Why were you actually concerned you were going to lose to Poland?
I'm always concerned when France starts as a clear favourite in a game. Usually, it's not something that works out well for us. But in this particular case, it did. So I'm not going to complain.
I feel bad for one man here, Philippe. Poor Olivier Giroud. Yeah. I was intending, he scores the goal. I'm thinking we're going to have a nice big chat about Giroud with Philippe. And then
we can.
But just Mbappe steals all the headlines again. Okay. Let's start with Giroud then. Let's talk about Giroud first.
Should he? I don't know. I don't think that Kylian should steal the headlines again, because when you think about what a day it's been for the French players, Hugo Lloris is equaling the record number of appearances for a French player, 142. That's amazing. Antoine Griezmann, who was again absolutely magnificent, we've got to talk about Griezmann in his new role, has played his 71st consecutive game for France, which is just, I just can't believe I'm saying this. And Olivier Giroud not only scored an absolutely beautiful goal to go above Thierry Henry in France's all-time greatest goal scorers, but also had a superb all-round game. And I think his first touch on Kylian's first goal was just sublime and, tells you all you need to do. I mean, his performance tells you all you need to know about him today. And then on top of that, of course, we've got the young man who scores two astonishing goals. Where can we start? So we can talk about Olivier Giroud. I mean, it's absolutely magnificent.
Well, the question, Philippe, is that, whether or not this guy gets the respect he deserves. He's now scored 52 goals for France. He's the record
goal
scorer.
I think he has it now, don't you think?
He does. I certainly respect. But to put it this way, there's a lot of WhatsApp threads going around, and one of the guys in here texted, one of the guys, I mean, his name is Simon, and he was like, Giroud is amazing. He said, I've just decided Giroud is amazing. And I said, there's a lot of people who are probably thinking this. Like, it's a bit like Benzema. It took a while. It's only really in the last few years that people have decided Benzema is like world class and an absolute amazement. And maybe the same thing is belatedly happening with Giroud.
For very different reasons. But the fact is that Karim Benzema stood in Ronaldo's shadow, Cristiano Ronaldo's shadow, for a very long time in Madrid, and people didn't realize how brilliant a center forward he was, because he's first and foremost a team player, as is Olivier Giroud, by the way. And when it comes to Giroud, I think he is not what he seems to be. And I think that it's a kind of dissonance between the perception that we have of him as a human specimen almost, and what he actually does on the football pitch, which I think quite a few of us find difficult to reconcile, because it doesn't look like he should be that kind of player, but he is. And he's a subtle player, he's an intelligent player, he's technically superb, he's got a magnificent sense of positioning and space. He's a wonderful and very cute finisher, as we saw again today. But he is that colossus. You know, you look at him, he looks like a kouros, like one of those antique Greek statues. And he's a magnificent human specimen. And I think people tend to be fooled by his appearance. And because of that, decide this is the kind of footballer he must be. And he's not. And this is why today he scored his 52nd goal for France. This is why every single club that has ever released him or let him go or pushed him towards the exit has regretted it. This is why every single club which has welcomed him after he was pushed out towards the exit has been congratulating themselves about taking him on, be it Arsenal, Chelsea, or Milan. So he is, and I think we have to get used to that idea, because also he can appear slow and ponderous, more of a dray horse than you know, one of those beautiful Arab horses that you will see screaming across the sands in the desert. He's not that physically, but he's many other things. And today we can say, as I've been saying for a very long time, he's simply one of the very best players France has ever produced. He is. Mm. He genuinely is. And it's not because he looks like what he looks that he should be denied the respect he deserves for that.
One of the things that I think marks him out from other top-class players kind of throughout the history of the game, throughout the moment in the game that we have now as well, is a complete lack of ego, I think, looking at it from the outside. That he obviously has a cast-iron confidence in his own ability, but he's also prepared to say, well, if Deschamps wants to play Benzema, then that's fine. If I'm called upon, I know I can do a magnificent job for this team. And he appears to be just serenely able to deal with the kind of slings and arrows of a football career. Better, I think, than you have any right to think a player who has scored a half century of goals for one of the great national sides has. And I think that's a key part of his armoury. Just this ability to say, if I'm not wanted at Chelsea, if I'm not wanted at Arsenal, that's fine. I'll go somewhere else. I'll be respected there. If I go into the French national team, I'll be respected there. If I'm not on the team, that's fine too. I think that is maybe the thing that sets him apart.
Yes, I remember having a conversation with him when things were not going too well at Arsenal about 7 or 8 years ago. And we met, you know, beyond the mixed zone. And we had a chat about how things were going for him. And things were difficult because he was used as a sub, or he clearly wasn't the first choice for the team any longer. And, you know, we journalists thought, well, he's going to look for a way out. And he said, and, you know, in typical Olivier Giroud fashion, looking at you in the eyes, say, no, I'm going to stick around and show them that I can do it. I can do the job. And so he did. And he was back in the team. And that's his attitude. It's probably due to the fact that you have to think that this young, he's still a very young man, certainly compared to me. And he still was playing in the France's third division when he was 23. So he's not somebody who's gone through he hasn't had a normal pathway, so to speak, to superstardom, and he's not a superstar anyway. So, and his work ethic has been absolutely exceptional from day one, but his confidence in what he can do has also been. And it's true, it's very unusual to see somebody who can combine incredible self-confidence with a total lack of ego when it comes to playing football. And I think when you've got those two qualities together, you're a very, very good man. You're a very, very lucky, manager to have a player like that with you. And Deschamps is very lucky in that regard because he's got two like this. He's got Giroud and he's got Griezmann. Two players who are willing to work very confident, trust their own abilities, and are also capable of putting themselves at the service of their national team, of their team, completely, which is a huge advantage to have, honestly, when you're manager of a national team.
You're loving Griezmann by the sounds of things at this World Cup, Philippe. What is it about him?
I think that what he's doing in this World Cup is absolutely astonishing, and he's not going to make the headlines. But when I see a player who is actually very near the top in terms of goal scoring, when you look at France's all-time charts, when you see a player who's been scoring goal after goal for Atletico, and you see him accepting to play in that kind of Andrea Pirlo role, deep-lying playmaker, completely against what is, the grain, as far as he's concerned. He's always played as a nine or a nine and a half, or sometimes a support striker, but that's not what he's doing these days. He's really a deep-lying playmaker, like Daniel Bravo was for PSG. Apologies for the French reference. But yes, what Andrea Pirlo did at the end of his career, when he moved from, being a number 10 to being the regista just in front of the back four. And Griezmann has accepted to do that. And not only has he accepted to do that, he's done it with consummate intelligence and understanding of what his role is going to be. You saw as well today in the game how his role evolved during the match. He started very deep, and as France asserted its control over the game, he was going forward and more forward. And he does that, and there's absolutely no ego in there. I mean, this should be obviously basic for any football player. That's what you're taught in any football team. But to have players of that caliber doing that without looking happy to do what they're doing. And Griezmann, honestly, he's assisted goals. He's played a huge role in France scoring goals in this World Cup. He hasn't scored one yet, unless I'm forgetting something, because it's very easy to forget something in this crazy, the way games are going. But he's been absolutely one of the stars, as has been Hugo Lloris as well, by the way, who was tremendous again today. And Deschamps, in a way, that's what makes me quite optimistic for this World Cup, as far as France is concerned, is that Deschamps has got players who are very much like him in terms of their mental outlook on the game. People who are... He's got the superstars who can do something extraordinary. Obviously, Kylian Mbappé, we're going to talk about him in a second. But also, Dembélé, Moussa Dembélé, has been better in this World Cup than I've ever seen him for the French national team, ever. But he's got players who are willing to sacrifice themselves.
If Giroud is not what he seems to be, as you said earlier on, what about Kylian Mbappe, Philippe? Is he what he seems to be?
yeah, he is. He's probably the best attacking player in the world at the moment in terms of efficiency. What can you say about him? I don't know. I've taken notes because, that's what you do. You try to take notes to understand what the hell is going on here. And there are moments like, you put the pen down, you think, okay, that's Kylian. Nobody has the right. It's the quickness of thought. I was really, by the way, really interested to hear Mauricio Pochettino speaking on our friends at the BBC, for whom he's analysing, he was analysing this game and talking about a player that he's been with, for quite a while, and explaining that there was something lacking from his game, which obviously is not finishing quality or trickery or technique or speed, but it is his positioning and the way that he understands space on the football pitch, which I have to say there were several examples of it this evening. But there are progress has been made, I think, in that. It seems ridiculous to say that, but he hasn't quite. If you look, for example, okay, if you look at the goal that Lionel Messi scored yesterday, with the bad first touch from Otamendi, which he turns into an assist, and he just threads the ball into the corner of the net, that is based on preternatural perception of space on the football pitch. It's like I should be at this spot exactly at this time and do this little move to my left to put myself in the best position to hit the ball with the inside of my foot. Now, Kylian Mbappe doesn't do that. Kylian Mbappe has got all the talent in the world, but he's not quite at that stage of understanding of his position should be or his movement should be, because he's so good simply when he has the ball at his feet. I think, you know, many people have noticed that or make that that comment that when he has the ball at his feet, he seems to go faster, which is, of course, absurd. He doesn't. But he seems to go faster because everybody else would go much, much slower and he doesn't. And he still doesn't quite have that, but he's 23. He's 23. He's already got 5 goals in this World Cup. He will probably end up beating Miroslav Klose as the top goal scorer in the World Cup. We just don't know how far he can get. I mean, I'd love to hear you say what you think about it, because about him, because I don't know. I've never seen a player like him.
Yeah, it's that explosiveness that I think is, you know, there's a moment after he's run 5 yards. So it's not one of those where he turns on a sixpence and he's immediately blindingly fast after 5 yards. But if he does get a chance to get 5 yards of a run on someone, the next 20 yards are just like extraordinary to watch. Like no other sports person I think that I've ever watched. You know, like there is like an element of it being unfair. You know, when he gets the ball out of his feet, he gets a 5 yard run on someone. After that, it's just, it is extraordinary. But then there is also like I think it's kind of similar to how we talk about Haaland sometimes, or how in a totally different kind of way you've talked to us about Giroud today, Philippe, in that kind of the physical attributes can blind you to the other parts. Because the two goals he scored today, like the finishes are legitimately unbelievable. For the first goal, I think there's one replay in particular where you can see his entire body is shaped to curl it into the far post, and Chesney takes a step to his left anticipating that, and then this hammer to the near post. I mean, there aren't many players that have the confidence to give a goalkeeper the eyes from 20 yards out. The combination of just like the raw physical pace that he has, and also this finishing ability that not many players have, makes him, I mean, Messi is watchable, but it's kind of an emotional experience watching Messi at this World Cup. Whereas with Mbappe, it's this visceral experience to just please get him into 10 yards of space and then watch him do things physically and ability-wise, the combination of which we're not used to seeing. We haven't really seen many players do that.
Yeah, well, that's some pretty good stuff from a lot of French players today. There might be just one blot on the French copybook today, though, Philippe, if you don't mind me asking, about Arsène Wenger, he's chief of global football development at FIFA these days. So he was doing this technical briefing on the group stage, being asked questions. At one stage, himself and Jürgen Klinsmann, who's part of the panel, were asked if the lack of preparation time has led to so many surprises in the group stages. Klinsmann gives a boring enough answer. Then Wenger comes in off his own bat and says, "I just add that the teams who were not disappointing with their first game performance, when you go to the World Cup, you know you must not lose the first game, are the teams who have experience, have results in former tournaments like France, England, Brazil. They played well in the first game. And the teams as well who were mentally ready, like Jürgen said, who had the mindset to focus on the competition and not on political demonstration." Now, Klinsmann hadn't said anything about political demonstration. That was Wenger there. So I don't know what you made of his... He's not the first person to make a similar point. I mean, Eden Hazard was talking about Germany. He said they would have done better not to do their mouths closed gesture and win. We're here to play football, all this kind of stuff. It seems to be a growing, I don't know, backlash maybe. What do you make of what Wenger had to say?
I don't know if it's backlash. I think it's totally ridiculous. I'm very disappointed, if not entirely surprised, by what Arsene Wenger had to say. He's been working with beIN Sport for a number of years. He's now decided to put his considerable expertise and experience at the service of FIFA. You know, you have to lie in bed with those people. So you go on with it, and you say things that they're probably quite happy for you to say. What was remarkable is that what he said was totally unprompted. Is that there was absolutely nothing in the question that would normally bring you to talk about the political aspect of the current World Cup, which, of course, we should be talking about all the bloody time. He decided to do it of his own bat and scored an own goal, to use a pretty bad metaphor. I'm not exactly surprised. It's something that I'm seeing a lot at the moment in the media, and it's something that I was expecting. It's the Stockholm syndrome, basically, settling in, where people have such a limited experience of what is going on at the World Cup that they decide that anything that is not related to their own personal direct experience of the World Cup doesn't matter. So basically, as these people do not see anything that is related to women's rights, migrant rights, trade union rights, political freedom, freedom of speech, you carry on like that forever. Mm. As what they're seeing is games which are well organized, clean stadiums, decent public transport, very well tooled up five-star hotels, and then they'll bugger off in 2 weeks' time and they will say, "How Qatar is a wonderful place." Well, yeah, okay. I don't need to say much more about that. I think you can feel and understand when I think about that. It's particularly galling to see that in the mouth of a man who has been for a very long time somebody who has been associated with the higher values in the game, somebody who's been very vocal against teams deriving advantage from unfair financial
doping. He was the one who coined that
financial
term.
Doping, somebody who was up in arms against Bernard Tapie in France, against Roman Abramovich and others in England, and who seems to have been, well, first of all, he's been quite happy to take the euros, dollars and pounds of beIN Sport and other people, and which he's of course today doing as well during this World Cup. And then answering the call of the great football dictator, Gianni Infantino, and becoming a mouthpiece for him. And these are harsh words, but I mean them. And I hope I will have a chance at one point to discuss with Mr. Wenger these choices of his. I don't think it will make for a particularly pleasant conversation, but because for me, he was a model. He was an inspiration. And I think for many other people. And what we see, what's happened, we're simply beyond disappointment.
It sounds like you're quite surprised that he has put himself in a position where he trots out a line like that, are you?
No, I'm not surprised.
No?
I'm disappointed.
Right.
That's not quite the same thing. I'm shocked, but not surprised. And the thing is, he's going to get an awful lot of blowback from that, and rightly so. But I think we've come to this point where there's this dissociation. It goes way beyond Arsene Wenger and FIFA, where I can see and read on social media or in broadsheets or listen to on radio stations and TV stations to people who are using this quite extraordinary argument, if that's an argument, because it is not one, of... Well, you know what? I've been here for a couple of weeks. You know, it's not so bad. I can still get a drink at my hotel. People are quite nice to me and so forth. How bloody thick have you got to be to understand what is at work here? You know, you would, if you had gone to Germany 1936, Italy 1938, Argentina 1978, you would probably have been able to say exactly the same thing.
Hmm.
Or in, of course, Russia 2018 and Beijing 2020. You would have been able to say that. It's the usual, that's why nation states and in particular dictatorships invest in sport. It's because you buy useful idiots along the way. It's very easy, it's very cheap. Because people reduce everything to their own personal experience and don't think for one second about what's happening beyond the kind of Potemkin village that they're made to see and visit.
Okay, well,
I'm still enjoying the football, but I'm trying to enjoy the football with my eyes open, and I'm not going to and saying what Arsene has been saying, it's not opening the eyes, is actually ignoring what the message they should be transmitting to your brain is, as in for example, ignoring the political dimension of this competition, as the Belgians have, by the way, because they completely chickened out.
Didn't help them much on the football pitch, by the way. It could be pointed out to Eden Hazard that.
Absolutely. I mean, Eden, and I find more disappointing from Eden Hazard than from Arsène. And because I would have thought that Eden was a little bit more tuned in than that. And I would also give the perfect counterexample, which is the fact that the most overperforming team in this World Cup has been and will remain the team that has been the most vocal, most open and clearest about the political side of this World Cup, i.e. Australia. Thank you, Socceroos. Thank you. You were absolutely magnificent on the pitch and you were magnificent off the pitch too. So there you go. You showed the complete absurdity of this point of view. If that's, you know, I don't want to dignify it by calling it a point of view, of this pronouncement by Wenger, and which is, I mean, it's such a disappointment. I can't tell you. I mean, it's horrible.
Philippe, listen, great to catch up. Thanks for bringing us that point of view as well. Thanks a million.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much, guys.
All right, Ken, let's get talking again. You witnessed Messi against Australia last night. How are Australia?
Our Australia.
They're our Australia. They're all our Australia now, or they certainly would have been if they'd scored that goal at the end and got level. Would they have been, actually? Would they have been the villains of the World Cup?
No,
if they'd knocked
everyone
Leo Messi
would have hated
out?
Australia.
Yeah, true.
Truly hated them.
Yeah, nobody wants it. We've all been in that situation. You feel like the world is with you, but nobody really wants a workman-like team knocking out Leo Messi when he's in this kind of form. And it didn't come to pass. What was that like last night? Messi in particular.
It was amazing. It really was amazing. It's so long since I've enjoyed a game like that. Just in terms of, you know, being able to just kind of going wow at this guy over and over again, and like the crowd just going crazy, just sort of willing him to do. You know, he was completely in tune with the crowd, which hasn't always been the case. You know, with Argentina, obviously, and there's been so many games where things have just been kind of weird or not going well, or it's tension and he's kind of pale and like, you know, nothing is going right. And this was just the opposite of all that. It was like, yes, you know, he's absolutely on fire here. This is amazing to watch. You know, it was brilliant. It was fantastic.
The goal was amazing for so many reasons. Probably the most amazing part, the execution from the point that he got the ball to actually scoring the goal was brilliant in its own right. The type of stuff we've seen him do, but maybe we shouldn't take it for granted that he's still able to pull this kind of thing off at his age in a World Cup match. But the fact that he caused the scenario that created the goal with his pressing and his pissing off of the Australian defender Aziz Behic in the first place was remarkable. You haven't seen that too often. Occasionally in his career he gets annoyed and presses. He did it in this case.
Yeah, I couldn't understand what was going on. You know, when he ran after him, I was like, what's he doing? Like, this is just so uncharacteristic. Running and pressing him into the corner and winning the throw. And then obviously there was that sort of angry exchange between them. But I didn't see any previous incident or provocation. Messi evidently just thought, okay, this would be a good place to... And what happened is that Behic was wound up and immediately gave away the free kick, which then was which then led to the goal. Where we were sitting in the stadium was row AA. That's the one behind row Z, directly under the massive air conditioning vent. So it's absolutely freezing watching this game in the highest possible row of the stadium. But at least that was right down, literally right down in front of me. I was at that end of the pitch and got a really good view of everything that happened, which was just Messi just sizing up the situation and like, just, you know, he's like, I know exactly what I need to do here. I wonder, is it going to come off? And just executing it amazingly. I mean, the way that he shoots, like, so quickly, you know, like he takes a touch off Otamendi and then like the next touch is a shot, but like you don't see the shot coming, you know, and it's in the net before you, like you might say, oh, the goalkeeper, it's not right in the corner. The goalkeeper reacts late. The goalkeeper reacts when he sees the shot. Like, he can't, you know what I mean? You know that he's probably going to shoot, but you just can't anticipate the moment when he does. And by the time he has, the ball's halfway in. And I think, you know, from that moment on, everything he did was amazing. And the whole crowd is just going, absolutely crazy for every single one of these moments. And there's more of those Messi, Messi sort of worshipful chants than I've ever seen before at a match involving him. You know, people are just looking at each other and laughing. I mean, this is amazing. Like, this is just amazing. Yeah. To be here to see this, this is beautiful. Like, this is, you know, it's like the farewell tour. Like, except unlike, you know, the who was it who did the Hell Freezes Over tour? I can't remember. Some one of those old sort of dad rock bands who said, we'll tour again when Hell Freezes Over. And then their reunion tour much years later was called the Hell Freezes Over tour.
Well, there was the 25-year Frank Sinatra farewell tour. Like, literally, it went on for decades, you know?
Hell Freezes Over was Eagles, the internet tells me.
Was it Eagles? Yeah. Well, there's never going to be. We know that's not going to happen. This is it. Like, this could be, you know, could have been the last game against Australia. Could be the last game against Holland, against Louis van Gaal. Could be the last game after that. Could be Brazil in the semi-final. I mean, a World Cup final. But, you know, it's just great that he's really playing well. Finally, he's really playing well for Argentina in the World Cup, because year after year, tournament after tournament, for one reason or another, it just hasn't happened for him. You know, even when he won the Golden Ball, even when he won Best Player in the World, he really didn't. You know, you see him receiving that award. It's not just because they've lost; because he's embarrassed to get it. He knew, like, you know, he played well in the group stage and then kind of just fizzled out in the knockouts. Didn't score. Had never scored a knockout goal in the World Cup until last night. You know, and this is his fifth tournament. I mean, Mbappe has got not nine goals in the knockout stages. Is it five in the knockouts? He scored two tonight anyway. Obviously, absolutely phenomenal as well. But in a different way. I mean, this is a guy at the peak of his powers. Messi is like, kind of really can't run anymore. Like, has to go past, can only get by on pure skill and intelligence. Like, has no ability to run.
But he did it so often in the second half. I was amazed. How many defenders did he beat in the second half? It was real, almost piss-taking Messi.
Yeah. But it's all little changes of direction or changes of acceleration. It's not like you saw. Did you see what Mbappe did to Frankowski today? Down the left wing, you know, that sort of kicked the ball past the guy and just run past him. I mean, to have that done to you in the World Cup finals. I mean, oh my god,
the communion with the fans, like you touched on there, is amazing. You sent us the support seemed absolutely wired up for this. For the whole game, you sent us on some audio. We can actually bang it in now. It's the Argentina song that people will be hearing almost like pretty relentlessly through the game, even when things are a little bit slow on the pitch, as they were in the early going, even when they concede a goal and the team need a bit of a lift. And I presume especially after Messi scores his goal, it all gets ramped up a fair bit. Another thing that has been pointed out, I think Gavin Cooney might have pointed this out, you don't see that many of them with phones. It seems to be, I'm sure it's plenty of them, but, you know, in comparison to a lot of other nations' fans, like our own, I'd say at this point, probably 70, 80, 90% would have their phones out at these amazing moments, especially at the end of games. It's not quite the same. Argentina seem to be properly engaging with this messy experience.
Well, maybe it's because of the way that they do the hand thing. You know the sort of style that they have. It's a slightly floppy wristed action.
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of the rhythmic thing, but the hands sort of, it's almost like the outside of the wrist is facing forward, and they kind of flop it forward a little bit as they're singing along, you know, in time to the music. So you can't do that holding the phone, right? I mean, you could, but it would look stupid. You're supposed to be like fluttering your little your scarf or flag or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it, like if everyone's holding a phone, that doesn't work. So, you know, culture is the enemy of technology.
Yeah, they also, I think, take their role seriously. You know, like, they're not there as dispassionate viewers of the Leo Messi show. They absolutely believe that they have a role to play. I mean, like, the difference in noise before and after Messi's little set two with Behic, like, it was, as you reflecting on Messi's goal last night, I was like, oh god, you know, and it all comes from the throw in, that he wins. But it's not just that. It's the reaction to him winning the throw-in, the reaction to Bech getting in his face a little bit. Like, the place was electrified. I mean, it was a fairly sedate pace for whatever it was, 36 minutes. It was a fairly sedate game to watch. And then all of a sudden, the crowd are into it massively. And I feel like it's not just an idea of them reacting to what's happening on the field. They think that they can set the tempo, and if fans think they can do that, then they're probably right. The second they decide that we make that much of a difference to the outlook of our team, then, you know, if you believe it, it's gonna happen if you believe it.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're doing it the whole time, you know. I mean, they have these lads standing behind. They were at the far end of the pitch from me. They were all just standing on the wall behind the goal, like as though they were back in Buenos Aires, you know. And obviously the stewards, you know, didn't bother to, excuse me, you've got to sit. Like, okay, well, I suppose we'll just let them do this. And, you know, they've got the drums and they're kind of leading these chants. So they were doing it all throughout. And every so often the sort of rest of them all join in. And I actually love that song that they're singing, Muchachos.
Let's give it another blast there, guys. Let's throw that in there again.
Yeah, I really like it. I mean, it's just this, because it's kind of both sad and happy at the same time. And, you know, it hits a kind of a sweet spot. And also the rhythm of it, they're great at singing in rhythm, you know what I mean? Like, you hear crowds, you know, say English football crowds or whatever, the chants are usually short and to the tune of either Sleep John B or you know, I mean, we all, there's about five tunes, you know what I mean? Whereas these are like long, complex songs with like a lot of lines that everybody knows, you know, and they stick with it all the way through. And I mean, if you're asking me, it's more to my taste. It's, I mean, it's just better. Yeah, I think that's the way that I, it's the way I see football, it's the way I see life. What can I say? So they have, yeah, they've been making a big impact. And obviously there's like loads of the fans there weren't from Argentina either. I mean, you have an overwhelmingly blue and white crowd in the stadium. Not everybody is coming from Argentina or knows these songs. A lot of them are holding up their phones, you could say, because they're just drinking in the experience. But it was amazing. And I mean, the other thing about Argentina, right, is that they're not really that good.
Yeah, there's like, always a chance. I mean, they were so close to conceding an equaliser, needing... This is what you know, you wrote this amazing piece last week about what appeals to people about Argentina so much. And I've always liked Argentina more than Brazil for whatever reason. Part of it, certainly in recent times, is their fallibility. They're in this game where they're playing against mediocre opposition. They've got Leo Messi, the greatest footballer of all time, playing like he's 24. And they still need last-ditch tackles and last-second saves not to have to go to extra time. It's almost like the opposite of the Man City phenomenon that you talk about, where you basically know what's going to happen before the match starts.
Yeah, I mean, they, like, especially towards the end when like Argentina were going to, I mean, or Australia rather, were getting a chance. I mean, the run by Behage was incredible. You know, that would have been an absolutely amazing goal. This was the fullback who had given away the. Who had given away the free kick that Argentina scored from in the first half, went on this dribble, beat three men, and only the last guy, I think it was Romero, I'm not 100% sure, was it maybe Fernandez, who stopped him?
It was Lisandro Martinez came across
Yeah. Lisandro Martinez, who came on at half time, because they switched the system at half time because Papu Gomez, the winger, had been injured, and so they went to sort of three at the back. It's hard to say what worked better, because I mean, they had chances in both halves, and obviously they had so many chances in the second half, which Lautaro Martinez was mainly guilty of missing, you know. And he's really had very a terrible World Cup.
It is very funny what's happening with Lautaro Martinez, because I mean, I even heard myself saying it, you know, someone asking me, who do you think is going to win the Golden Boot? I was like, ooh, well, you know, Lautaro Martinez, you know, is a dark horse, not having really seen much as in any of Lautaro Martinez playing. And ever since the World Cup started, he's been terrible. Like, absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
He's obviously a very good player. He's obviously very good if people have been tipping him to win the Golden Boot. But, like, in this World Cup, he has been so bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of based on, this is the guy who's going to be, you know, profiting from Messi, yes, passing the ball sort of thing. And, you know, he got unlucky, I suppose, against partly bad luck, partly bad execution. But, you know, he scored twice, two disallowed offside goals against Saudi Arabia and
a couple of chances where he really should have been able to stay onside and went too eagerly. Last night, though, I mean, Messi just lined him up with like this is an easy chance for a top forward, and he just absolutely completely missed the goal, which was terrible. But the one great thing I think about Argentina at the moment, since, you know, we can talk about Martinez and maybe he'll, unlike Lukaku, at least he gets another chance, probably will come on at some point, at least against Holland he might do something. But Julian Alvarez is brilliant, and I think he's a really good player to kind of complement what Messi is doing, because he's playing with this great tenacity and drive. I mean, I don't mean to say that he's come some kind of workhorse, because I think he's a really, really skillful player, but he's very team-minded, he's very self-sacrificing. You know, he's absolutely willing to do all the extra running that this role involves, and he's pretty quick as well, you know what I mean? He's not just like a willing workman-like forward. He is actually, he's an all-rounder. Like, I've been impressed by how strong he is, you know what I mean? This is a guy who obviously has been sort of kept on the margins of Man City because they've got Haaland, and it's like, where do you fit him in? There's a lot of competition to get in the team. He makes Argentina a much better team, I think. And you see the finishing as well, and the instinct finishing for the goal against Poland was brilliant. The instinct it's not instinct, it's kind of discipline. It's like when Australia played that ball back to their goalkeeper, and it was Rodrigo de Paul who was doing the kind of Andy Robertson press, going from one player to the next player to the next player, as they helpfully kept passing the ball in the same direction. You know what I mean? So he could just keep running after it, which is so stupid, you know, from Australia. And Alvarez kind of understood, okay, this is, Rodrigo's doing some good work for the team here. But you know what would really help out Rodrigo here is if somebody else came and applied a little bit of extra pressure from a direction that Australia clearly aren't anticipating, because this goalkeeper is just watching that ball. And was able to come in, steal it. And the finish is actually really good as well. You know, he didn't, there was a defender there, the goalkeeper is sort of in the way. The direction he's moving as he steals the ball is not, doesn't make it that easy to score. And he scores brilliantly. So I think he's really good. But, you know, there are obvious weaknesses in the Argentina team. And they're up against the side, a manager who is just a legendary figure among coaches, and this could be Ruben Hals.
He's high on life. Did you see the video of him cavorting out of the amazing. was it out of the stadium or out of the hotel?
They were landing back at their hotel, is what I'm thinking. Yes,
after the game,
so that was the hotel staff that was welcoming them home.
So it was so cool,
dancing in, you know, and Van Hal, like, just so funny. And you know, I was reading obviously Diego Torres's report on this. He was evidently at the USA Holland, Netherlands, I should say, of course, which presented him a dilemma, because on the one hand you've got, Americans, and on the other hand you've got Louis van Gaal, who has kind of thrown out the attacking traditions of Dutch football, you know, in his last campaign, and I suppose in the one before, the World Cup campaign before it, and, you know, he's decided to not play in the kind of classical Dutch way, but to play on the counter with deep defending, you know, three at the back, two at front. And, you know, this is like nothing really Van Gaal did before.
Still scored the team goal of the tournament.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. But like, again, this is apostasy. You know, this is heresy. So how do you play this? I mean, on the one hand, there's this renegade Dutchman, and the other hand you got Americans. So essentially, it was to talk about the sort of soft simplicity of the Americans, who were led by the wily Van Gaal to dominate in areas that didn't matter, and confused by their feeling of superiority, they kept letting basically Dumfries just run riot up the right side. Like, Dumfries just absolute wrecking ball in this game. And the soft and simple Americans didn't really know what hit them. It was a mugging by the Dutch and but I just feel as though if any coach is going to be able to put his finger on the weaknesses in Argentina, this is the guy who's going to be able to do it. And unlike Poland, you know, and unlike Australia, Holland, and unlike Mexico, Holland do, or Netherlands, I just keep thinking of that guy who writes me the angry letters when I say Holland. He's probably not listening, but he's still in my head.
Do you know what? You've used Holland so much in this tournament that I thought there was a change. I thought that maybe Holland has become the way you're supposed to say it again.
No, sorry. I'm just used to saying Holland in football. I'm sorry. I grew up with it. I'm trying to change and say Netherlands.
Yeah.
The difference between them and the other teams that Argentina have beaten in the last three matches is that they have, well, a great coach, but they also have explosive strikers who can score goals, and they also have, they have strikers in Gakpo and Depay who can score goals out of nothing. I mean, Lewandowski is a better striker, I guess, than either of those. I mean, you know, he's certainly got a far superior record if you look at goals per game, but he does need the team to help him out. I mean, this is what the Poland manager has been sort of saying, you know, when after the Poland-Argentina game, where Lewandowski just looked like one of the ordinary other players next to Messi. He's like, yeah, well, you know, we didn't give him any balls. We need to help him. We need to give him... You know, I think that Depay and Gakpo are players of the type who can actually make things happen themselves. So they don't need, and all they need is a ball into the Argentina half and a one-on-one, or, you know, one against one on a defender, and they can score from that situation. So I think it's obviously going to be a much more difficult game for Argentina, which it should be. This is the quarterfinals of the World Cup. You know, the games are supposed to be, you know, if you've got this far without having some really hard games, you've been lucky. I think they maybe have been a touch lucky so far in the opponents that they faced, and now this is the serious stuff. An amazing match and prospect, and I think as well the most beautiful kit matchup in the World Cup.
Yeah,
it's my favorite one: orange against light blue and black. I mean,
could
that's
be.
Not an important detail, but I just thought I'd share that with you. Huh?
No, it is. We know all about the history. Listen, we'll talk more about that fixture closer to the time. Monday's games: Japan versus Croatia, 3:00. Brazil versus South Korea, 7:00. Over to you, permutations, man. No, only joking. There are.
Well, if it finishes in a draw, they'll go to extra time.
Get the abacus out.
If the teams cannot be separated, then get the abacus out because it's penalty zone.
Very quickly, Ken: Japan, Croatia, Brazil, South Korea. Any chance of a shock at the Brazil game, and who's going to win the other game? Because I have absolutely no idea who's going to win that 3:00 game.
I think that Brazil should win, but it's sort of interesting. It's an interesting place they're in. You know, obviously they lost the last game, which is not good for their confidence. Even though it was a game that the result didn't matter because they were already qualified, and you know, in the games where they needed to win, they've done what they had to do. They haven't wowed anybody, I would say. And then they have this problem with Neymar. He's injured. Is he going to play? I mean, what's worse, if he's injured and doesn't play, or if he's injured and does play? You know, either way, it's bad. So, yeah, it will be interesting to see. I've seen South Korea play. And I think that they are not good enough, really, ultimately, to beat Brazil. I think they're a team that's going to work really hard. It's going to be a tough game for Brazil. But I don't see an upset in that one.
Brazil
I
to win, Japan,
I do see
Croatia.
An upset in the other one.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I'm not saying I'm definitely going to see it happen, but I just feel as though Japan are the kind of team that could expose Croatia a bit.
Is it even a massive upset if Japan beat Croatia at this point?
I mean... I would say
World Cup finalists last time out on.
I know, but they haven't been particularly impressive in the group.
I mean, I would say Croatia are going to be the favourites. I mean, do you want me to check the odds? I mean, will I see?
No,
the,
we don't need to do it.
No,
that
we don't need the odds. We watch enough football between the three of us, Ken.
I'm going to give my own opinion. I would not be shocked remotely if Japan beat Croatia. I'm seeing this as a 50-50 game.
Yeah. Well, Croatia aren't odds on or anything like that, but Japan are 3-1, so Croatia are just over even, so that's kind of what the bookies are expecting. But yeah, I think that I could see Japan beating Croatia all right. I mean, remember how I was at Belgium against Croatia were not great, and they gave away so many chances, and they obviously should have lost, and we talked at length about the reasons why that didn't happen, and it took a very special situation with Romelu Lukaku and whatever the hell happened there, to let them off. And yeah,
So again, Owen, you're saying it's not even an upset. I think it could happen. But yeah, I do expect Brazil to beat South Korea.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Ken.
Owen, and thank you, Karen.
Thanks for listening. The Second Captains podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. If you sign up to the World Service on secondcaptains.com, you'll hear all the episodes ad-free. And we will be back for members only with loads more from the last 16 of the World Cup during the week.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.